Welcome back to the Deep Dive.
It's good to be back.
Our mission here is always pretty much the same. We take these really dense, complicated subjects.
Yeah, the ones that can seem almost impossible to untangle.
Exactly. And we stack up the most critical sources, and we just try to pull out the absolute maximum insight for you. That aha moment that shortcuts your way to being, well, profoundly well-informed.
And today's topic is definitely one of those.
It really is. Today, we are wading into one of the most intellectually charged topics in modern American religious history. We're doing a critical analysis of the LDS Church's Book of Abraham and the very complicated apologetic arguments used to defend it.
And you really have to say, defend it against overwhelming Egyptological evidence. That's the core of the conflict.
Absolutely. So this deep dive, it really demands that we operate with, intellectual rigor. The subject matter isn't just complex, it requires navigating some highly specialized fields.
For sure. We've collected sources that reflect the critical analysis of the primary documents. I mean, we're talking about everything from the recantations of internal scholars to detailed mathematical and linguistic refutations.
Okay, so let's unpack this for everyone. If you're looking for that essential foundation, let's start with what we can call the Book of Abraham problem. What is the basic setup?
The foundation is it's straightforward, but it's also absolute. So in the 1830s, Joseph Smith gets his hands on a collection of Egyptian papyri fragments.
Right, the ones that had been dug up in Egypt.
Exactly. And he makes a very explicit declaration about them in 1835. He says they contain the writings of Abraham, written by his own hand upon papyrus. This, he claimed, was the source material for what is now the Book of Abraham.
Which is canonized scripture in the LDS Church.
It is. It's in the Pearl of Great Price.
So, what did that source material actually turn out to be once people who could read Egyptian got a look at it?
Well, that's the thing. Decades later, specifically after the surviving fragments were rediscovered in the 1960s, they were examined by, the global consensus of Egyptologists, experts like Dr. Robert Rittner, the late Richard Parkinson, dozens of others.
And their conclusion was.
Unanimous. The fragments are common Egyptian funerary texts.
Funerary texts.
Yep. Specifically, they're parts of the Book of Breathings or the Book of the Dead. These were basically standardized instruction manuals designed to help guide a deceased person, the mummy, into the afterlife.
Okay, so for the layperson listening, what exactly is the Book of Breathings? And why is the fact that the fragments are that text so damning to the translation claim?
It's crucial to understand the function. Imagine it like a standardized burial contract or a manual. The Book of Breathings was put with the deceased to make sure they navigated the transition to the next life successfully.
So it's got prayers, instructions.
Prayers, vignettes, instructions, all specific to the individual the scroll is written for, in this case, an Egyptian priest named Hor. And these texts are incredibly common. But more importantly, they date to around 200 BC.
200 BC.
Right, which means they were created roughly 1,000 years after Abraham is traditionally thought to have lived.
So you have a 1,000-year chronological mismatch, and the content is verifiably a generic funeral instruction manual, not some unique patriarchal scripture.
And that's it. Joseph Smith's claim of a literal translation from an ancient source is just. It's demonstrably wrong. The evidence is definitive.
Which is what forces the LDS Church and its apologists to create these explanations, these ways to bridge what seems like an unbridgeable gap.
Exactly. And our mission today is to give you that critical, evidence-based shortcut to understanding the two main defense theories they use, and maybe more importantly, why those theories fail when you hold them up against the primary source material and just basic logic.
Okay, so we're going to start by looking at the ethical ground these arguments are built on. Then we'll dissect the lost scroll theory, and after that, the catalyst theory. So let's start there with the ethical framework of Book of Abraham apologetics. Because where you start really determines where you end up.
It really does. And this discussion often pivots to theology, but you have to ground it in academic discipline first. The core problem here is this tension between pure objective scholarship, with what a PhD is supposed to represent, and a motivated faith-based defense.
Right. Because when scholars have these specialized degrees in, say, Egyptology, the audience, the average church member, just assumes they're applying the highest standards of academic rigor.
They make that assumption, and it's a reasonable one. But that expectation is, while it's shattered by a direct admission from a very prominent LDS scholar, Carrie Mullestein. He's a BYU professor and an Egyptologist.
And this admission wasn't in some peer-reviewed journal, was it?
No, not at all. It was in a 2020 clip for Fair Mormon, which is an apologetic organization.
And what he said, It's really the key to this whole thing, isn't it?
It's the Rosetta Stone of this entire academic dilemma. Wolestein openly stated, and I'm quoting, "I start out with an assumption that the Book of Abraham is true. Therefore, any evidence I find, I will try and fit into that paradigm."
He starts with the assumption that it's true.
He starts with the conclusion.
So he's just admitting he's working backwards from the answer he wants.
He's explicitly admitting it, and the context you mentioned is key. He said this in a safe space for an audience of believers, but this single admission, it fundamentally recontextualizes every single article he writes for a general audience.
Because it completely reverses the scientific method.
Completely. I mean, Science 101 is you form a neutral hypothesis, you gather evidence, and you let the evidence lead you to a conclusion. Wolestein starts with the conclusion, the Book of Abraham is true, and then he uses his PhD, his expertise, to reverse engineer arguments. He's designing them to make the inconvenient evidence, like a funerary text from 200 BC, somehow fit into his required theological paradigm.
And as the sources point out, he does not put that disclaimer, "By the way, I started knowing the answer," in his articles for Deseret Book or in church magazines that are read by millions of members.
And that omission is where the ethical problem lies. It gives the appearance of objective scholarly analysis to the average reader. They're led to believe Wolestein arrived at his conclusion through impartial study,
when in reality, he's just using his academic credentials to push a predetermined theological outcome. The average person just isn't equipped to see the difference.
Not at all.
Speaking of these tactics, Mulestein's colleague, John Gee, he's often seen as the most aggressive advocate, and he frequently attacks critics who point out these methodological flaws.
Yeah, Gee often falls back on rhetorical defenses when he's faced with academic critique. He claims that critics, and he names people like Dr. Robert Rittner and the scholar Dan Vogel, are using the ad hominem fallacy and poisoning the well.
And for anyone listening, ad hominem just means you're attacking the person instead of their argument.
Right. But what's so ironic is that the critics are doing the exact opposite of an ad hominem attack. They are not questioning Gee's personal character or his morality.
They're looking at his work.
They are meticulously analyzing his academic output, his scholarship, and providing just mountains of evidence to show that his interpretations of the papyri are biased or inaccurate, or in some cases, you know, just fabricated to support the Book of Abraham. They're attacking the argument.
Which is what you're supposed to do in academics.
It's the correct procedure. By claiming a poisoning the well, Gee is trying to shift your focus away from the evidence the critics are presenting and back onto the supposed malicious intent of the person making the argument.
And our sources show this isn't just some rhetorical debate. It has real consequences in the academic world.
It does. It was reported that Gee was removed from an editorship of a professional journal, and the reason given was that he was using that journal, a platform that requires academic neutrality, to directly attack the scholarship of Dr. Rittner.
So he's using the journal to fight his apologetic battles.
Exactly. And that behavior just confirms this pattern of prioritizing the defense of his faith over the impartiality and rigor that's expected in academic publishing. The scholarly world, which runs on evidence, it saw the conflict of interest.
Now, to put Gee and Wolestein's approach in a bit of historical context, we should probably look back at where this kind of apologetic started. The sources bring up Hugh Nibley.
Yes, Nibley. He was an extraordinary intellect, a prolific writer, but he was not an Egyptologist, and he established what's often called bookshelf apologetics.
Bookshelf apologetics.
Yeah. His method was to produce these massive volumes, incredibly dense, often very difficult to read, just filled with obscure parallels and ancient trivia. The goal wasn't really to convince a specialist.
It was to convince the average member.
Right. The message was, look at the sheer volume of this material, produced by someone much smarter than you. You don't need to understand the details. You just need to trust that the answer is in here somewhere. It replaces clarity with complexity.
It's a signal of authority, not an actual argument.
Exactly. It provides institutional comfort. But that strategy, you know, it works on the outside, convincing the lay member not to worry. But the biggest challenge to this whole methodology is now coming from within the church's own scholarly ranks.
This is a huge point. Let's spend some time on the recantation of Brian Hoglett.
Hoglett's shift is seismic. I mean, this guy was a fixture in the church's academic structure for a long time, a former BYU and Maxwell Institute scholar, and critically, an editor for the authoritative Joseph Smith Papers Project.
He's an insider's insider.
And an apologist. He even co-authored a book defending the missing scroll theory.
So what did his role as the Joseph Smith Papers editor give him access to? that maybe G. and Muhlenstein didn't focus on as much.
His role meant he worked intimately with the primary manuscripts, the literal documents created by Joseph Smith's scribes during the so-called translation process in Kirtland. He saw the sequential Egyptian characters, the scribal notes, the context of the fragments, all of it firsthand.
And that deep, granular knowledge of the actual evidence,
yeah,
it changed his mind.
Completely. By 2018, he explicitly rejects the missing scroll theory he once championed. He openly agrees with the critical assessment of the documents provided by scholar Dan Vogel, who is a well-known critic of the church's origins.
So what was the nature of his break with his former colleagues? Was it just a disagreement?
It was absolute. Hoglund stated he no longer holds his former apologetic views. He's no longer involved in the field. But the real academic hammer blow came when he described the scholarship of Guy and Muhlenstein as abhorrent.
Abhorrent. Wow. That's exceptionally strong language to use against colleagues in the same very small, specialized academic community.
It's an indictment of their methodology. It's not a theological disagreement. Hoglund, having seen the documents up close, recognized that the apologetic theories just didn't account for the physical and documentary evidence. To call their work abhorrent means he views their methods as fundamentally dishonest and damaging to the field of Egyptology.
It's the most powerful internal signal you could get that the defenses being offered are not sustainable scholarship.
It really is.
That internal ethical tension, the scholar versus the apologist, is the perfect segue into examining the two major theories they created to deal with the facts. Let's start with the one designed for plausible deniability, the lost scroll theory.
Right. So the lost scroll theory is the church's official position. You see it laid out in their Gospel Topics essays. The idea is conceptually simple.
What's the pitch?
The pitch is, since we only recovered fragments of the papyri and the original collection was larger, the true Book of Abraham text must have been on a missing scroll or a long roll, something that was perhaps destroyed in the Great Chicago Fire or just lost to history.
Which sounds like a perfect defense. I mean, if the original source is gone, how can anyone prove Joseph Smith didn't translate the writings of Abraham from it?
And that's exactly why it was established, to create that crucial, plausible deniability. The problem is the theory completely collapses under the weight of four categories of evidence, all of which rely on the fragments and documents we do still possess.
Okay, let's go through them. Let's start with number one, the surviving manuscript evidence. What did the working documents actually show about Joseph Smith's process?
So we have what are known as the Kirtland Egyptian Papers, or the KEP. These are the actual working manuscripts created by Joseph Smith's scribesmen like Warren Parrish and William W. Phelps.
The guys who were in the room.
The guys in the room. And these papers show, demonstrably, that the scribes were translating Egyptian characters sequentially from the papyrus fragments we still have, the ones adjacent to that famous drawing, facsimile 1.
Okay, so how does this sequential translation debunk the idea that the real source was somewhere else?
Well, because the scribes would record an Egyptian character from the surviving fragment, and then right after it, they'd write multiple verses of English text that became the Book of Abraham.
So one Egyptian character equals many English verses.
Many verses. And this pattern continues, line by line, character by character, following the flow of the surviving fragment. So you have to ask, if the true Book of Abraham was on some long-lost scroll tucked away somewhere else, why would the scribes' working drafts meticulously anchor the translation to the fragment we know is the Book of Breathings?
It proves that they believe the text they had in front of them, the funerary text, was the source document.
Precisely. The working documents are a direct contradiction to the lost scroll theory.
Okay, that's a powerful refutation, just based on their own methodology. But the second refutation uses the Book of Abraham's own internal text against the theory.
Yes, this internal evidence acts like a cross-reference. In Abraham chapter 1, verses 12 through 14, the text describes a scene, a sacrificial altar, and it specifically tells the reader to look at the representation at the commencement of this record.
A representation.
Which is a clear reference to the facsimiles, specifically facsimile 1. Those are the illustrations that are attached to and are part of the surviving funerary papyri.
So wait, the narrative that Joseph Smith translated, the one apologists claim, came from a separate lost scroll. That very narrative tells the reader to look at the surviving fragment as confirmation.
That's it exactly. The content of the Book of Abraham narrative, which talks about the figures and the altar, is inextricably linked by the text itself to the physical fragments Joseph Smith had in his possession.
It just kills the argument that the source was somewhere else.
It absolutely does. Why would the text on the Lost Scroll keep telling you to look at the pictures on the Book of Breathings fragment? It makes no sense unless they were in fact being treated as the same document.
Okay, let's move to the third refutation. This is the most scientifically rigorous one, the one that physically puts the Lost Scroll theory in a box, the mathematical debunking.
Right. This is critical structural analysis. It's been published in academic journals like Dialogue, and it builds on earlier work by scholars like Claus Baer. These studies use the physical properties of the surviving fragments, and they combine that with the length of text required by the English translation we see in those working manuscripts.
Okay, so we already established that Joseph Smith was getting a massive amount of English texts from just single Egyptian characters in the fragments he had.
That's the starting point. So based on that density, the ratio of Egyptian characters to English text in the Campid, the entire published Book of Abraham would require a scroll that was at least 511 centimeters long.
511 centimeters. That's over 16 feet.
Over 16 feet of papyrus. That's what you'd need to hold the text they claim was translated. Now, what does the physical evidence of the papyri we have actually allow for?
What do the fragments tell us?
Well, the surviving fragments are physically adjacent to each other on the original scroll. Scholars have analyzed the gaps, the lacunas, the missing spaces, and the damage patterns from how the scroll was originally wrapped up.
What's the conclusion?
Their mathematical conclusion is that structurally, a maximum of only 56 centimeters, that's about 21 to 23 inches, maybe two more columns of text, could possibly be missing between the fragments we have.
Hold on. You need 511 centimeters of source material.
16 feet.
But the physical structure of the scroll itself only allows for a gap of 56 centimeters.
That is the devastating conclusion. There is mathematically no room, I mean literally no physical space, for even one-tenth of the current Book of Abraham to fit into the missing portion of that scroll.
So the Lost Scroll that the theory requires just, it couldn't have existed next to the fragments Joseph Smith owned.
It's like claiming you lost an 18-wheeler truck inside a 20-inch desk drawer. It is physically impossible.
So given that the manuscript evidence, the internal text, and the math all refute the Lost Scroll theory, it must be relying almost entirely on the fourth point, unreliable eyewitness accounts.
That's all that's left. The entire defense rests on these dramatic claims of a long scroll or multiple rolls that were, in some accounts, stretching through two rooms of a house.
But the sources for these claims are shaky, right?
Extremely shaky. You have accounts that were recorded 63 years after the fact, based on the alleged memory of a 5-year-old child who saw the papyri decades earlier. I mean, historians treat that kind of late secondhand memory with extreme skepticism.
And you also have to contextualize the language they used.
You do. We can reference the description from contemporary observers like Charlotte Haven. When she described the papyri, she likely used the word long just because it was physically longer than the standard size of paper she was used to writing on in the 1840s.
So long is a relative term.
It's totally relative. A 20-inch section of papyrus, which fits perfectly with that 56-centimeter maximum gap, would certainly seem long and exotic to a lay observer, but it doesn't equate to the 20-foot, two-room spanning scroll that apologists need to make the Lost Scroll theory work. The theory is physically, textually, and mathematically just untenable.
That structural analysis is fantastic, and it really shows why the more sophisticated or progressive apologists have basically abandoned the Lost Scroll theory and moved on to the Catalyst theory.
Right. The Catalyst theory came about because scholars, especially those who can see the definitive failure of the literal translation and the mathematical impossibility of the Lost Scroll, they needed a theological way to salvage the Book of Abraham as scripture.
So define the Catalyst theory for us.
Okay, so it posits that Joseph Smith was not literally translating the Egyptian characters. Instead, the physical papyri fragments served merely as a catalyst.
A catalyst for what?
A catalyst for revelation. The idea is that by looking at these ancient documents, Joseph was spurred into a state of meditation, reflection, and revelation. And that allowed God to give him a completely separate, unrelated, but genuinely true text about Abraham.
So the text is still scripture because God revealed it, Not because Joseph translated it from the papyrus.
Exactly. The source doesn't matter, only the inspiration. And that's why it's appealing to more progressive scholars like Richard Bushman or Terrell Givens. It just bypasses the whole physical evidence problem.
But this solution creates its own set of contradictions, ones that are arguably even more damaging.
Far more damaging. And the first contradiction is Joseph Smith's own words describing what he was doing.
How does the catalyst theory clash with the historical record from Joseph Smith himself?
It directly contradicts his explicit claims. In his journals and historical accounts from 1835 and 1842, Joseph Smith repeatedly and unequivocally said he was translating the Egyptian records.
He's used the word translating.
Over and over. Yeah. He also defined his prophetic process for the Book of Mormon as a genuine and literal translation. So the catalyst theory forces you to believe one of two things about him, and both are catastrophic for his standing as a prophet.
Okay, break down that dilemma. This is the fool or fraud problem.
Right. If the catalyst theory is true, then Joseph Smith was either fundamentally deluded, he genuinely believed he was performing a literal translation when he was actually just receiving an unrelated revelation. That paints him as a fool who didn't even understand the nature of his own divine gifts.
And the other option.
Or he knew it was pure revelation, but he intentionally and repeatedly claimed he was performing a literal translation from the characters. And that would make him, by definition, a fraud. The theory rescues the text, but it completely dismantles the integrity of the prophet and his claimed gift.
So that's the first problem. The second major contradiction involves the problem of divine perfection. You can call it the trickster God problem.
Yes. If the Book of Abraham was pure, untethered revelation, why would God allow that revelation to be anchored to specific physical details on the papyrus that are verifiably incorrect?
You're talking about facsimile 1.
Look at facsimile 1. This is the diagram in the Book of Abraham showing a sacrifice scene. The physical fragment had missing sections or lacunas. If God was inspiring a pure text about Abraham and inspiring the drawings, why did that divine inspiration cause Joseph Smith to incorrectly fill in the missing parts of the drawing with improper characters?
Because he was guessing.
He had to be guessing. The fact that he filled them in incorrectly, based on his own flawed 19th century knowledge, suggests he was relying on his own intellect, not receiving perfect divine input. A God of order wouldn't inspire text and then intentionally include false, self-incriminating data points, like the wrong characters in the gaps that reveal the prophet was just making it up. The mistakes are too specific.
And this leads us to what many call the ultimate definitive refutation of both theories, the smoking gun of facsimile 3.
It's absolutely conclusive. Because this artifact is extant, it's printed right there in the Book of Abraham, and it isn't subject to any debates about missing fragments.
So what is facsimile 3, and what did Joseph Smith claim about it?
Facsimile 3 is a hypocephalus. It's a small disc that was placed under the head of the deceased. And Joseph Smith provided extensive labels and translations for the figures and characters you can see on it. For instance, he labels one figure as King Pharaoh, whose name is given in the characters above his head.
Okay, and what does objective Egyptological consensus say facsimile 3 actually is?
Egyptologists confirm it's a standard Egyptian funerary document from the Book of the Dead. It's a protective text meant to ensure eternal warmth and light for the person who died. The figures are identified as standard Egyptian gods, Min, Isis Hathor, the four sons of Horus, and the deceased individual.
So what about Joseph Smith's specific labels like King Pharaoh?
Every single label and character translation he provided for facsimile 3 is fundamentally and demonstrably wrong.
Not just a little off, but completely wrong.
Completely wrong. The figure he calls King Pharaoh is universally recognized as the god Min. What he calls a pagan idol is the goddess Isis Hathor. This is not a matter of interpretation. It is a verifiable, documented failure of translation.
And if he fails to translate the basic printed material he himself presented as the source,
then the catalyst theory provides no defense either, because the alleged revelation resulted in a completely false explanation of the physical object it was supposedly inspired by. The physical error and the revelation failure are inseparable.
This brings us back to Carrie Mulestein, because the sources document his highly problematic attempt to manufacture parallels to defend these facsimiles, specifically using something called the Leiden-Demotic Papyrus.
Right. This specific incident is critical. It's a perfect example of using academic credentials to commit what is demonstrable misrepresentation. Mulestein claimed that the Leiden papyrus, which has a lion pouch scene similar to facsimile 1, somehow mentioned Abraham.
What did he claim it said?
He claimed it explicitly said, "Abraham upon his couch." Now, if that were true, it would have been an academic bombshell, a huge triumph, linking Abraham to a contemporary Egyptian funerary scene.
That sounds like definitive proof.
Yeah.
So what did the actual examination of the Leiden papyrus show?
It showed that Melusstein's claim was completely baseless. Egyptologists, led by Rittner, exposed the fact that the name Abraham does appear on the papyrus, but it's in a list, a syncretic list of names written in Greek, which is part of an entirely unrelated text on the document.
Unrelated how?
The text is identified as a love charm, a magical text. And the name Abraham is listed alongside names from different religious traditions, probably because they were invoked for their perceived ancient power.
So the name is in a Greek list
yep.
on a love charm, and it's not even associated with the lion couch image at all.
Not at all. In fact, the lion couch scene on the Leiden papyrus depicts a woman, not Abraham. Melusstein took two completely unrelated facts, a name in a list and a drawing, and he smashed them together, manufacturing the, quote, Abraham upon his couch. This isn't just an academic error. This is a clear instance of intentional misrepresentation of source material to support a faith claim.
And using his BYU title to lend credibility to a fabrication.
That's the problem.
Okay, that brings us to the final, almost desperate apologetic strategy that gets used when all other evidence fails. The argument that everyone else is wrong.
Right. This is the idea that since the papyri date to 200 BC, the meaning of the words could have fundamentally changed over the 1,000-plus years since Abraham's actual time.
So what was once the writings of Abraham just morphed into the common Book of Breathings?
That's the argument. You are functionally arguing that every scribe, every priest, every person in Egypt for the next 1,000 years got the translation wrong and fundamentally changed the meaning of their most common funerary practice.
And not just them.
Not just them. You're also arguing that every single modern Egyptologist, from Champollion onward, has also fundamentally misunderstood these texts. It's an argument from a chronological loophole.
It seems to ask for a miracle of linguistic mutation that just defies the historical record.
It does. I mean, linguistic change happens, of course. But the core semantic function in standardized religious texts, especially over just a millennium, does not completely flip from being unique patriarchal writings to generic burial rites. It's like arguing that if we read Green Eggs and Ham 1,000 years from now, the text would be universally understood as a story about spaghetti. It's a defense that requires you to reject the entire field of Egyptology.
This analysis of the theories has been extremely thorough. So let's try to synthesize what we've learned and connect it back to the listener trying to become well-informed on this.
Okay. The primary takeaway for you should be this. The reason Book of Abraham apologetics are so convoluted and confusing is that the main institutional defenses, the lost scroll theory and the catalyst theory, are mutually exclusive.
And they're both definitively refuted by the evidence we have.
Right. By the source material, by Joseph Smith's own historical claims, and by simple physical math.
So one theory insists the source is gone, but the surviving working manuscripts prove the prophet was translating sequentially from the source we do have.
And the second theory insists the source was just spiritual inspiration, but the text and the facsimile show that the so-called revelation resulted in verifiable, physical, and historical falsehoods about the artifacts themselves.
They're completely at war with each other.
They are. And this highlights that central ethical conflict we started with. The church institutionally funds and promotes scholars like G. and Melusstein, who, despite their academic credentials, use highly questionable methodology, starting with a conclusion and fitting the evidence, and promote these irreconcilable, easily debunked theories.
So why should our listener care about this failure of honesty within a, you know, relatively small scholarly community?
You should care, because the apologetic method used here, intentionally withholding or misrepresenting crucial data points like the mathematical limits of the scroll or the sequential manuscript process or the definitive errors on facsimile 3, it's academically irresponsible.
And when that irresponsible defense is used to prop up the truth claims of a system that asks for so much.
Exactly. When it supports a system asking for lifelong commitment, 10% of your income, and complete loyalty based on a promise of revealed truth, it transforms an academic failure into a huge institutional ethical failure.
So if you're a listener encountering these defenses, you need to know you are not reading objective scholarship. You're reading carefully curated, predetermined arguments.
That's it, exactly. And this leads to the really powerful question that Brian Hoglund's recantation implicitly poses. If the catalyst theory renders the Book of Abraham's origins, and I quote, indistinguishable from a fraud, meaning the prophet claimed literal translation but delivered a flawed revelation-based text,
yeah.
Then why does God, who is described as a God of order and who supposedly leads his one true church, allow his primary modern scripture to be defended solely by competing, convoluted, and demonstrably dishonest theories that are so easily refuted by the very physical evidence Joseph Smith left behind?
And that lack of clarity, that reliance on mutually exclusive, flawed defenses, it forces you to question not just the translation, but the very nature of the divine communication itself. It's a conflict that only true knowledge can resolve.
A powerful thought to end on. And seeking that true knowledge is always the mission.
Thank you for guiding us through this. It's challenging but vital material, and you provided the depth needed to really understand the failures of these strategies.
It was my pleasure.
And thank you, our dedicated listener, for joining us on this deep dive. We'll see you next time.